Could I have a volunteer to read the little section from What the Buddha Taught?
Just from the top?
Yes.
Right speech means abstention from telling lies, 2, from backbiting and slander and talk that may bring about hatred, enmity, disunity, and disharmony among individuals or groups of people. 3, from harsh, rude, impolite, malicious, and abusive language. And 4, from idle, useless, and foolish babble and gossip.
Can I have a volunteer for the next paragraph? Lee?
When one abstains from these forms of wrong and harmful speech, one naturally has to speak the truth, has to use words that are friendly and benevolent, pleasant and gentle, meaningful and useful. One should not speak carelessly. Speech should be at the right time and place. If one cannot say something useful, one should keep noble silence.
Thank you. So I've prepared a few questions. We don't have to get through all of these, and they're meant merely as openings to help guide your own thinking and to help unfold a conversation here tonight. So certainly don't feel like you have to answer them in the same order that they're written, or that you can't just bring up your own reflection when you feel moved to do so. One of the things that strikes me is that there are only 8 slots on the Eightfold Path. There are not 9 things on the Eightfold Path, or it would be the Ninefold Path. And what is it about speech that makes it so important for there to be a right speech? Brenda.
It may influence how people think. So it affects people certainly emotionally, intellectually, and guides action on that.
Todd?
Oh, it's an action.
Lee?
It keeps a community together if one has a right speech within it.
Richard.
I think the act of speaking is the act of creation. We create our own reality. And the word is very powerful, so I can talk to myself in my head and create a world image that may or may not be accurate. And when we speak out loud, we're inviting others to join us in that view of reality, which may or may not be accurate, or may or may not be helpful. The one thing that struck me was the first paragraph, number 3, abstention from harsh, rude, impolite, malicious, and abusive language. That captures and sums up the political discourse in the last year. It's very discouraging. And I think this is an example of how harmful wrong speech can be in our society, in our world. Thank you.
Right speech is not just, we all think that we should speak the truth, or we should speak what comes out of our heart, but it's also very important to make sure what the other person, how it is going to affect the other person. So, thoughtful, mindful speech is the right speech.
Second, what you just said, I fell into a similar trap earlier in the week when I felt compelled to speak truth to power, or to be a warrior for truth, and my truth is not necessarily the truth of the person I was talking to who felt similarly that they were a warrior for a very different truth, and it became conflicting. So I'm so glad that this is made available, because I feel like I stepped on a landmine, and this is very sensible, that just because one may feel compelled to use language to make a change or to affect other people for what one believes is right, it could have the opposite effect. It could still be harmful. So this aspect of how things are said as opposed to what is said, and being sensitive to how messages can or should or might be received, is something that I realize is very important to learn.
Date?
So the Eightfold Path is a way for us to live our lives authentically as human beings. And speech is one of the things that makes us human. It's essentially unique to human beings. And speech and the symbolic thought that goes with it are so fundamental to who and what we are, that it seems to me that the Eightfold Path necessarily included within that speech.
Lee.
I just wanted to say that in a contentious situation like the last debate was, I thought it was such a wonderful moment when somebody from the audience asked the debaters to say something nice about each other, to find something that they liked about the other party. And it was just a slap in the face kind of thing to them, because they were all geared up, you know, to tell everybody how terrible the other guy was. And so they had to find something good to say about each other. And that was, a very important moment for the country. I don't know about them and their campaign managers, but it was for the people watching the debate. Just to say, yes, we can. We can say something good about each other.
Is there anything that... Yes, Sylvia.
Okay. I keep reading this, and just one thing. I can hear my mother's voice. Well, if you can't say something nice, don't say it. I can hear her voice. Speech is very intimate. And people recognize my voice. And I don't have to say it. People know me. They hear my voice, they recognize it. It's a very intimate exchange when you're talking. And one can feel the mood, can feel maybe the feeling behind it, or all the emotions behind speech. And if one is using sign language, it's kind of the same way. It doesn't have to be audible. So it's a very intimate environment, and of course, it's part of the Eightfold Path, because one has to have the right thought and the right perception and the right understanding, and this is all coming out in what one says. But I know oftentimes I'm going to be angry. I'm going to convey that
Does anyone have additions to the list of abstentions? What would you add that you think is not represented here? Or what was surprising to you to see on this list? Todd.
Are we talking about language?
Are you asking me?
Anybody has answered. I mean, is that what we're saying, or are we talking about speech?
How are they different to you?
Huge. Because you said how, and I'm quite curious about words, if that's what this is about. Because recently, a couple of years ago, I heard from somebody who seems somewhat reputable the way that we communicate, and I'm not sure if that's, I mean, that is, in some ways, the basis, right? It is a huge percentage, has nothing to do with words. Mm. So are we talking about language, or are we talking about specifically words?
I think it must be communication.
Right, so, and that's huge.
Yeah.
I'm probably reiterating, but it's like something like 70% is in body language, and then some like 10 or 15% is just an intonation of my words. So, I mean, that's not very much left for the actual symbolism. So I think in some ways it's probably perhaps utmost of how you're communicating. I mean, like passive aggressive, for example, who would have none of that. In some ways, it'd be quite harmful.
A teacher once who would remind us that sarcasm literally means to rend the flesh, so he just would forbid sarcasm in his class. Bonnie. Bonnie.
Yeah, just what you guys were talking about. So one thing that's not on here but is kind of obvious is like screening. You might be saying like something where the words are not incorrect, like, oh, why weren't you on time? Or why weren't you, you know, but if you're screaming, it really can affect the other person and have a very negative consequence. And another thing would be maybe not as serious in the terms of intention, but I think being unclear or vague or not thinking through words, so you might have good intentions, but then the words that you actually use, if they're not thought carefully, someone could interpret it very differently from how you intend. And I think this becomes even more critical as we use email more as a chain of communication. Like, a lot of misunderstandings and hurt feelings come from pure misunderstanding because we lose the body language, we lose the tone of voice, and all we have is the text. So you have to be very precise with the exact words that are used, especially in Silicon Valley.
I was surprised to see the idle, useless, and foolish babble and gossip, which I think is about 80% of sports television. Dave.
I'm actually wondering, this is what Tom and Bonnie just said. I think all of this about the Eightfold Path arises from a primitive tradition, right? This was all an oral tradition. And I think the way that we now look at speech versus writing versus email versus teleconferencing and all this, I mean, those ideas, it was not split apart like that. Speech was all of those things. Those were all aspects of speech. And it was only when writing and other things were introduced that we started seeing this whole notion of what was body language you could have and not have and so forth. But I wanted to make a suggestion, not an extra thing to add to the list of abstentions, but maybe just a commentary on number 4. There was something that came up in the discussion a few weeks ago, a couple of remarks that were made by Umar and Florin about practice together in silence and the importance of that. So much of the talk that goes on, so much of the speech that goes on, you know, there's that wonderful phrase, an awkward silence, where people sort of silence comes in and everybody suddenly is terrified of the silence. And so we have this babble that is basically this sort of useless kind of social glue that we feel that we need. And there's so much value in the same case in the session where we're all together for hours and hours, and we're not doing that. And instead of feeling all nervous and fragmented and separate and worried about what the other person is thinking, we come together in a much deeper way. So that's what number four obviously speaks to me more than just high gossip. It's something much deeper than that.
Tanya.
One thing I would like, I mean, I'm thinking about is a point of censorship, where, I mean, it's not like self-imposed censorship, which is whether it's the right time to speak or whether it's the right thing to speak, but it's like some externally imposed censorship where it's like you're saying something that is truthful, but like an external entity, you know, for manipulation purposes, somebody goes, no, you shouldn't be saying this, you shouldn't be saying this. So we should not lose the track of the fact, you know, obviously all these points are extremely valid. Every single one of these, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, every single one of them. At the same time, we should not ignore get into a mode of, you know, heavily censorship.
That's a great place. Why don't we go there? Question number six is: should you censor your speech? Is censored speech right speech? Richard.
Well, to call speech censored, it kind of implies like if I have something that I want to say, but I don't say it out of fear because it will upset the other person or cause an argument. So I think it's complicated. It could depend on the situation. Sometimes difficult things need to be said. Difficult conversations need to occur. So if the intent is to, you know, just say something hurtful, mean-spirited, and bitter, then that's, I consider that wrong speech. But if the intent is to speak your truth because it needs to be spoken out loud, regardless of what you know, how it's received. And what I'm saying is, I think the intent is important. And sometimes it might be better to just bite your tongue, wait till, or you know, it's not an easy decision.
When I was ordained, Brenda gave me a scroll.
A scroll?
A scroll. With an R.
Oh.
And it has a picture of the Buddha on it, and it says, "Right speech, shut mouth." I don't know whether that was intended for me specifically. But that comes to mind for me for right speech. Sharmila.
Didn't we all say that this is a person right speech is some definition for another person right people? So many things make a right speech. But I think the main challenge is in, under certain circumstances can stick to the right speech. For example, when you're frustrated, is your speech coming out right? When you're angry, is your speech coming out right? If you're terribly sad, totally out of mood, somebody not in good mood, does that mean you can speak anything you want? No. So I think right speech, we all know kind of by definition what is right speech, but the challenge is in certain circumstances, can we stick to it? Because I think that is a big challenge in understanding. I'd like to share an experience.
Please.
And it's really ingrained in my brain, that experience. And this, when I took my daughter for soccer games, and sometimes we have to travel long distance, so it would be like a, more than an hour. So I would like to carpool. So we had this parent man. He was a middle school counselor. And every time at the games, he would never, yell, or because we all parents sat together and he always spoke the right things. And I'm like, in the spirit of the game, you know, you tend to say something. No, you know, push, yes, go, don't let them, you know. But he would always say the right things. And I'm like, wow, he's a counselor by profession. He knows in whatever circumstances. He knows who is around him and he speaks really right, and this is something you should learn, not just professionally but in life, and I would always observe that. Until one day, we went to Concord and I decided to carpool with him and his daughter, and it was me and my daughter, and I sat in the front. And we started driving, his right speech and everything had impressed me so much, you know, like, okay, you know, this is what counselors are. And then in the traffic, somebody cut him. And the next 10 minutes, my daughter was like this, I could see in the mirror, big eyes, and I was like this. And we were all quiet. Because he wouldn't stop, because that triggered him somehow, I don't know. All the wrong words, all the words I didn't know meaning of, everything came out, but I knew what he was so much about. Until we reached the place, and then there was no apology, but it was like, that's how it should be. And then when they're on the field, again the right person comes, and everything is gone. So I was like, wow. Until this game, you know, I really thought, you know, you should learn how to speak right and how to be aware of the surroundings and how not to hurt. But when that moment came, so I feel the challenge is, you know, to stick to the right speech. That's because then you're not controlling yourself. I think mind control. What drives the speech? I didn't even know that man could know this many words. Like, is this the same person or what? So, it was an eye-opener.
I think that's very true. Luckily, the great thing about speech is that if you screw it up, you'll have a moment fairly soon when you get to try again. So luckily, we have plenty of chances to learn from our mistakes. You bring up a really great point, which is I feel like if you're observant and you go through life, you'll often find someone who handles a particular situation that you find difficult with some kind of grace that you didn't have the right words for. In my work at Google. Over the last 10 years, the people that I work with, just they're very good at communicating. And I've learned an awful lot just from watching them handle situations that would have really frustrated me. And they do it in such a gentle way that it's really inspiring. But yes, sometimes people push them off their rockers too. Lee.
I just want to comment on that, is that there are some things that are teachers for us, and I think that driving in the Silicon Valley is a big teacher. I mean, you have to observe how you react, how you feel, what you want to say, and then, you know, think about it. Think about the words that are coming to your mind, you know, when somebody cuts you off or is rude to you or something like that. And it's a chance to practice. You know?
Absolutely. Well, I think this actually is a good segue into how do you know right speech? Like when you're thinking about the thing you're about to say, what is it that tells you this is right speech, or what is it that tells you, maybe either I should shut my mouth or maybe I should think of a better way to say this? Yes, go ahead.
I think about how it's going to affect that person, what they're going to feel, as opposed to what you feel, what your need is, and why you need to say it.
Yes, say what can be heard. Yes, Megan.
I think if my ego is very involved, I need to think about it. You know, like if I want to make sure I'm right, or there's some kind of an ego feeling that, then I need to stop and think.
Red flag on the play. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, Vanessa.
I feel like I need, it's quite similar. I feel like I need some sense of equilibrium or something. Maybe just after zazen or something. I'm sort of feeling the most balanced, the least swayed in any direction. And I think you know when you're there. You know when you have that clarity, and you know when it's the moment to speak.
It's interesting that you draw the connection between mindfulness and right speech. Mm. Does anyone else have thoughts about that? Bonnie?
So for me, I know I need to pause and not speak right away when I feel impulsively like I must speak right that moment. Like, no, it's just like I'm too attached, and that, yeah, sometimes means that I will say things with, whether or not, I mean, it might be true, but it probably won't help the situation if I'm too attached, you know, if it's just a reaction, not an actual response, so.
Sharmila brought up an interesting point earlier, which is, sometimes you can be in difficult situations, driving in Silicon Valley or having an argument with someone that you love. I wonder if anyone has tips for when you have to try to adhere to right speech in one of these difficult situations. What are some skills you can try to use? Yes.
Well, listening might be one thing that I would toss out there. If you can kind of, if speech is involved, I guess it would seem that if speech is going on, that it should probably be two-way and exchange. And listening is something that's really been taught for the importance of listening, you know, I think it's probably in there.
That's a great point. I mean, we should call it right conversation. Sharmila?
Yeah, one thing I never understood in the school that they have the banned words. So even if you're caught speaking, there is this list of banned words, and after a certain age, the kids figure out some other word, which means actually that word, but you're not allowed to speak that word. Mm-hmm. Words are in the list of banned words.
Yeah.
So what is this motivation or this tendency to use certain words, like some of the words I don't want to say,
yeah,
but those are even professionally accepted at work.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the professional presentations and in conferences, on the stage, I see people using those words. And those words, because many times in the beginning, I didn't know, and I went and looked, what did he say in that frustration when the slide didn't work? And it really means that.
Yeah.
But, you know, when they speak pretty openly about it, and it's accepted. Like some of the words, again, I don't want to say, they're very well accepted in our daily conversations. And I feel, so how did these words come into being okay when in the school it was not allowed?
then suddenly we accept it, we even joke about it. You know, just think about some words. They're the first thing if you think about it. When you hear your teenagers speaking and, you know, people talking around it. So I would say if you can eliminate at least that, like however angry you are, no name calling or bad words, that can really, really help. Just that. No big thinking of how I say or what I say, but eliminate the first page, eliminate those words and go back to the school.
Thank you, Sharmila. Todd?
I'm a construction worker. Some of my construction buddies are really, they're my heart buddies. I think it's how. I don't think it's a list. I think it's how. So it may be inappropriate here, which is why we're not, but that's apropos. But in certain situations, it's a sign of actually love.
Richard?
Well, I'm also a construction worker, and I was in the Navy. I have a quite extensive vocabulary, and which I enjoy, and it can be an expression of affection between people who understand the way it's given and received. It really is in the context. And in a school or a professional workplace, it's really not appropriate. These are like cultural things that are subtle. And listening to you, it made me wonder, like, what would George Carlin think of this right speech? I'd like to hear what he would say. But the words themselves are not bad. It's just like, if somebody speaks yelling and swearing angrily, it's really like crying for help. Like, I'm upset, I need somebody to help me down. It's like the warning. It's probably better if somebody yells than if they hit. You know? So that's like, maybe that's their way of letting people know that they need attention and help. I don't know. Anyway, I limit my vocabulary here, and then also with my Aunt Pat, because she doesn't appreciate that. So I try to respect that.
I think this is a great segue into our last question, which is, you know, what do you do when someone doesn't use right speech with you? Like, if you hear someone who isn't using right speech, I think Richard's saying that sometimes it's a call for help. But what are some skillful means you can use to try to provide some compassion for this kind of person? Or at least, how can you keep yourself from getting triggered by someone else not using right speech? Yes.
Yeah, I was in office. I'm wrestling with this right now. Someone has actually, I made him so angry that they started calling me names in a work situation.
Ooh.
It's a blue-collar work situation where the gloves are kind of off and people don't go around thinking about right speech. Right speech means, what weapon can I use to, you know, to get back at this person? And my intuition, and I'm experimenting, rehearsing, if I could even do it, is to not speak, but I guess to use listening and to absorb if they're calling me names or really angry, to just take it in, you know, to just look at them and accept it. And another stage might be to apologize. Say, I'm sorry that if I've upset you, I'm sorry, in some way. But to just take it and not, you know, hit back, because there's no sense in that, it accomplishes nothing.
Yeah, besides escalating, I think that's a great point. Yeah. Sometimes they can be helpful even just to state the obvious. It seems like we're having a disagreement.
I think that would only elicit more expletives.
Did you say those are fighting words?
Yeah.
Dave.
So this reminds me of something that came up 7 years back when I took some negotiation training. And one of the points that they really tried to drive home is that a common cause of failed negotiation is that each side comes in saying the specific things that they want, and those two lists of demands or desires are incompatible with each other, and they just fight over it. And the key skill in a negotiation is to understand at a deeper level what the other person actually needs. What is it that's motivating them to come up with these specific things that they're talking about? And if both sides are able to do that, then it's much more likely that you can find some alternate way of framing those needs so that they're not in conflict with each other. So when somebody is saying something to you, that, I mean, if what they really need is to make you feel bad, then maybe you're sort of stuck. But if what they're saying makes you feel bad, and you can read between the lines a little more deeply and understand what it is they actually need, maybe there isn't so much conflict there after all.
That's an excellent point. I mean, hopefully you have different needs, otherwise you have nothing to trade, right? I was curious, where do you think this desire for gossip comes from? Why are we tempted by wrong speech? Bonnie?
I think it comes from insecurity. Because if we have a problem with someone and we're secure about it, like a problem with something they did, we would just go talk to them. But if we are afraid of rejection or looking bad or them not agreeing with us or us being outnumbered or any sort of negative experience, then we're just not going to talk to them. We're going to go talk to someone who will agree with us. And that causes gossip and doesn't get anything done except it's something to do with our frustration. Because we feel powerless to actually affect the real situation.
Megan.
I think it can also come from wanting attention. Like, if you have some juicy gossip, then people will listen. You know, there's some attention seeking, wanting a connection, maybe.
Vanessa?
I was just going to ask you, is gossip, this is a genuine question, is gossip always negative, or can there be sort of positive gossip talking about, you know, so-and-so's getting married?
I don't know. What do you guys think?
I don't know. And I'm a terrible offender. I really do. But I don't, I think gossip does get a bad rap sometimes, and I think it's a natural urge to, we like to know about each other. We like to know each other's stories as well. You know, you do like to know what's going on with people, often because we do compare, often because we like to feel ourselves superior, I think, for sure. I think there's an element of just wanting to live vicariously through other people, because we can't have the full human range of experience that everybody has. And I think, I for one, am fascinated how different people deal with different situations. You know, if a tragedy strikes somebody, well, how are they getting through that? Like, or, you know, something amazing happens to them. Well, fantastic. But I want to know deeper. You know, we read books, we watch films, we watch soap operas. You know, I think all with the same motivation somehow. I think it's a very human thing.
I think maybe if you're, what you're seeking is like a deep connection with someone and with to form a web of connection with the rest of the community, maybe there's a right gossip.
There's right gossip.
Maybe it's just that there's a lot of wrong gossip too.
I think part of it though is also that we feel insecure about ourselves, and sometimes, you know, this is why I think some of the popularity of these TV shows that show people whose lives are a train wreck, you know, so everybody could look at that and say, well, at least my life isn't that bad. You know, I wouldn't do that. You know, and it's just a kind of, it's a sort of an ego boost to us that, you know, that at least we may not be handling everything great, but we're doing better than those people on, you know, whatever that TV show is that brings brings train wrecks to, you know, into the light.
Todd.
Well, George Costanza says, all in all, I never like to talk, feel much more comfortable talking behind people's back. So, but there is a truth in there, in a way, right? Which is interesting about you in general, but in some ways, you know, there is a way where you actually have to reveal more by being confronted with the person. So you can be, in some ways, in a sense, being more comfortable without having to be maybe truthful. I'm not quite sure.
I think you're right. In some ways, this desire to gossip can be a red flag that's calling you to be courageous.
Could you say that again?
I think sometimes the urge to gossip can be a red flag that's calling you to be courageous. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Sharmila? I think gossip comes from idle mind or idle lifestyle. For example, if you're so busy, so many things to be done, and you know, and you tend to say, if there's something positive, talk to me, let's talk about it. Otherwise, so idle mind. A lot of gossip, I mean the negative gossip. Yes, there is good gossip and then there is hurtful gossip. I relate to that because sometimes there is a gossip like, you know, somebody's child got hurt. Did you hear about it? Do you know somebody fell from a bike? You know, the traffic over there is really bad. Ask your kid not to go. So that is a constructive gossip. So there's something about it. Positive. But, you know, he wants to marry this one, he's already married, and then, you know, this one's sister did that. That is something I don't mind. I don't know, does it come from I don't mind? You don't have anything to do? Something, I don't know.
Dave.
Going back to what Vanessa was saying, I don't know all about this, but I was reading recently that there is actually a fairly strong school of thought in anthropology these days that gossip is actually an evolved social behavior that has very, very deep roots in the history of humanity. And they've been trying to identify the functions of human coalitions and understanding what's going on and so forth. So, I mean, it's a little disturbing because we all grow up thinking that gossip is something that's, you know, very bad and nasty and evil and everything. But apparently, there's this school of thought about how language is accepted among anthropologists. So it's in fact a very deeply rooted human behavior. And they cite particular effects that it has in terms of the social glue inside the jar.
Megan?
Well, it says here, you know, idle, useless, and foolish babble and gossip. So it has adjectives in front of the gossip. You know, idle, useless, and foolish babble.
Not active, purposeful, and useful gossip. I think you're right about that, though. There's something about gossip in the service of small mind being this, like, way to get ahead or make your ego feel better, and maybe gossip in the service of the big mind being a way to form connections with people and to strengthen a community and to build songs with people that you encounter. I know, for example, sometimes about the only thing I can talk to my grandma about is her other kids, because she doesn't get out much, but she definitely talks to them. And so for her, inviting her to talk about them is a way for us to connect. It's a way for me to get also news about my cousins who I don't actually get very much contact with either. So, yeah. We're getting sort of close to the end of the evening here. I wonder if anyone has parting thoughts or reflections on our discussion tonight. Anything they found surprising that they learned or Anything that we didn't get a chance to talk about that they wanted to discuss? Vanessa.
Well, we touched before about being inspired by right speech. I think it's something that, I think it is almost an art form in a way. I think when you meet somebody who really has a way with expressing themselves, whether it's through words or through their body language, it really is an inspiring thing. And I think when, you can see the effect, you can see how the positive effects of that trickle out and touch people. And I've especially found in my experience, having been in the States for a short time, I think a lot of people here really have such a great gift with communication. It's something that's really struck me. I don't know if they teach it in school or if it's something in the water, but I think that people here are very good at communicating generally compared with my experience back in Europe. And when I told some of my friends from my Zen group in the UK that, you know, after Zazen on Wednesday, we come together and we discuss things and we talk about our feelings. It's almost unheard of in the UK. I mean, we just don't do that. We don't talk about our feelings. It's not very British. So it's very inspiring. It's a great experience to be exposed to such good speech from a group like this. So thank you.
Sylvia.
Well, you know, we're in Silicon Valley, and you know, I'm well aware that younger people, they don't like to talk. They want to text. You know, nobody calls anybody on the telephone anymore. You know, I get emails, and now I'm getting more texts. And I work with a young man who said to me that he's in his middle 20s, and he said that he thought it was rude to actually interrupt somebody by making a telephone call. God forbid the person's going to answer, number one. You want to be interrupting them. And this is speech. This is talking with another human being. And I'm just making a comment here, this whole thing about right speech, that there's this generation of people, I think, that they're just not accustomed to actually having a face-to-face conversation with another human being, a live person, not on the computer, Skyping or texting, and their social skills. You know, and it'd be interesting to hear what someone like that would say about right speech. You know, it's not the words coming out of one's mouth, but you know, I just think it's interesting. And I really do. I'm just making a comment here. You know, I heard that someone said to me once that these businesses are having to train young new employees on how to answer the telephone. But they're literally having to train them because they never answered the telephone in their lives.
Yeah.
I'm just making a comment.
Thank you, Sylvia. Todd.
I think he started out talking about how speech was intimate. Right? So that's quite courageous to be intimate in a way. So you can kind of backpedal or whatever by not revealing that intimacy by emailing and texting, I think. And yet it seems very peculiar to me too. That, in fact, body language and intonation are one of the most dominant forms of communication, and that's taken out. What if I want to know what clarity, even if I can't put it in words, I need to have, as I'm going to call it, a gestalt, which is all of the things happening, so I can kind of get some sense about maybe what's happening. So it is, I think it is kind of a very interesting time, very. And on the other hand, I have to say that I would have conversations with a woman at another place, and we became friends, and then she wanted to become my Facebook friend. And we actually, I think, she, after a few exchanges of typing, I met her again, and we are. We were closer or something. So it's like, it's very interesting. I don't know what to make of it either. But, so thanks for bringing that up.
Brenda.
Well, the counter that your point, so yeah, actually was also proposed that in some ways, especially in established relationships, email and texting can be an extremely intimate form of communication, which dispenses with the formalities of often the, oh, how are you? What's going on? And actually kind of gets through, you know, do you have time to meet? And cuts right through that and says, right, gets right to the point, right to the message. And you could text people a world away and you can be on the other side of the planet and say, hey, how are you doing? How was that event for you? And they can answer right back, oh, it was fabulous. Best thing I've ever done. This was amazing. So there are ways in which it's different, but it also somehow, I mean, also facilitates communication.
Both things and their opposites. Bonnie.
Yeah, I just kind of want to second what Todd and Sylvia were pointing out. It's really, for the most part, with young people, avoiding intimacy and vulnerability. Because through texting and also through images, Instagram, all these things, I can post my best looking picture with my favorite filter, and you know, I look just perfect in that picture, and that's my image, and that's what I put out into the world. Rather than face to face, you see my imperfections, and part of it is cultural, that parents are working so hard, and what do? The babysitter is an iPad, or it's a movie, it's a TV screen, and kids, they're not used to actually knowing you're worthy of human contact and human acceptance. And it's easier to hide behind a screen because that's what their comfort level is. It's very unfortunate. So that's what I've seen. And I also want to just go back to what Vanessa said about being inspired by right speech, because I find the first thing I want to do after listening to someone who has a lot of gossip is I just want to be like, oh my God, this person would not stop talking. And then I'm and also vice versa. When someone's talking to a very deep part of me and I'm inspired, then I'm more likely to inspire. So what I've realized is I need to kind of be mindful of what I'm consuming and listening to. Mm-hmm. And listening to gossip, it's like contagious. And also listening to inspiring speech is also contagious. So it's kind of like you are what you eat.
Thank you, Bonnie. That's a perfect place for us to end this evening. Let's all strive to make right speech contagious.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Leslie.
A wonderful hour. I'm just going to get it.